This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today we have a rebroadcast of an interview about incentives that states use to lure new businesses and encourage companies to expand. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research economist Tim Bardick examined the incentives in 47 cities across 33 states over 26 years. A version of the interview with Tim Bardick originally aired in March. So economists have always been interested in this idea, how tax policy, and in particular tax credits or special tax deals, work in terms of economic development. What did you do here that's maybe a little different from past studies?
Well, this database is much more comprehensive and detailed than previous attempts. There's no federal agency that collects data on what incentives state and local governments pay. Maybe that's for political reasons, I don't know. There have been attempts by researchers to do it before, but they've usually been very limited in terms of what industries are covered, what years are covered, and what kind of detail they have on different incentives. So where this differs is I have specific incentive results for 45 different industries that cover over 90% of U.S. jobs. And I also have data for 26 years going from 1990 to 2015. And so with this, and I also have data, as you mentioned, for 33 states that are over 90% of the U.S. economy. So with this data, we can answer questions we've never been able to answer before. How have incentives changed over time? How large are they overall? How do they compare across industries? Is there any sign that states are targeting high-wage industries or high-tech industries, or is there not much targeting?
Let's start with change over time. Has there been a different approach that states have taken over that 26 years? Has it evolved in some way?
It's evolved in several ways. Quantitatively, incentives have tripled in size. So they've gone from roughly 9 for so-called base industries, which are the industries in a state that sell their goods and services outside the state and bring new dollars into a state economy, which includes manufacturing as well as other industries that bring new dollars into the state and really help set the basis for the state's prosperity. For those industries, back in 1990, incentives offset about 9% of what state and local business taxes otherwise would be. Today, on average, incentives offset 30% of state and local business taxes for these base industries. So from 9% to 30% over a 26-year period. And that increase was particularly rapid in the 1990s. Since around 2001, 2002, it's been a more mixed picture. There's still some increase nationally, but some states have expanded incentives quite a bit, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Tennessee. Other states have made cutbacks in incentives, for example, New York, Missouri, and Michigan.
Now, you mentioned targeting. Are states trying to find certain types of industries, or are they targeting more on the basis of the number of jobs that might be brought in?
Well, this is actually the most surprising finding to me in creating this incentive database and then looking at it. I really thought that states were doing a lot of targeting, because when you listen to governors and mayors talk about their incentives, there's a lot of talk about creating high-wage jobs. There's a lot of talk about attracting high-tech industries. And we do have research and development tax credits that are aimed at high-tech industries. We also have job creation tax credits that often have requirements that wages be above a certain level. And actually, over this time period, when there's been this increase, tripling, a lot of the increase has been in job creation tax credits. That's been one of the key incentives that has gone up over the last quarter century. Property tax abatements have always been big, but what's really increased in the last 25 years is job creation tax credits. So I kind of thought that when I looked at the data, I would find a lot of targeting on high-wage, high-tech industries. I didn't find that. I mean, there's some targeting. If industries' wages are higher, incentives tend to be somewhat higher, but not much. If an industry's research and development spending is higher, incentives tend to be somewhat higher, but not much, at least for the average state. There are some states that do a little bit more targeting, other states that do very little. For example, in Michigan, there's almost no targeting of incentives. Essentially, whether you're a low-wage or a high-wage industry, you get about the same. Whether you're a low research and development spending industry or a high research and development spending industry, you get about the same. So we're really not, in general, nationally, we're not targeting very much. And Michigan is actually an example of a state that doesn't do very much targeting of its incentives.
Now, you've mentioned some states which have increased incentives. Is there some sort of a correlation where if one state decides that they're going to be more aggressive in trying to offer tax credits or tax breaks to businesses, that neighboring states, seeing the potential competition, might answer that in some way?
There is some. I mean, there's definitely some anecdotal evidence that incentives has spread from one state to another. So, for example, the increase in incentives in the 1990s seems to have been spurred a lot by Kentucky creating some very generous incentives that could be taken as credits against the payroll taxes that the company would otherwise withhold from workers' pay and send into the state for this personal income tax. And then that spread to Ohio, and then later on it spread to Michigan with the mega program. You know, and I think probably with Wisconsin and Minnesota, there's a little bit of competition between those two states that's doing that. On the other hand, we see very large differentials across nearby states in many cases. New York is a very high incentive state. Connecticut, not so much. Indiana is a very high incentive state. Illinois, not as much. South Carolina is a very high incentive state. North Carolina, not so much. So in many cases, we find these very large differentials between nearby states. It's very hard to figure out why the incentives differ. There's no sign that, say, higher unemployment rate states tend to have higher incentives. The biggest thing that predicts whether your state has high incentives this year is whether you had high incentives last year. I mean, it's much more consistent with kind of a political inertia model that some governor decide or some legislature decide to enact some incentive for some reason. Maybe the unemployment was high in that year, or maybe there was people who wanted a higher incentive and they decided to agree with that. And then once the incentive is put in place, it stays there for many years, even if the economic circumstances change. So we can't really find much correlation of these incentive differentials across states with the current unemployment rate of the state or last year's unemployment rate. We also don't find much correlation with the future success of the state. So, I mean, examples I've given, you know, you have New York and Connecticut. So New York, much higher incentives than Connecticut. Is New York a wonder state and Connecticut a basket case? I don't think people think that. South Carolina, high incentives. North Carolina, not so much. Is South Carolina just a juggernaut of economic progress and North Carolina, again, a disaster area? No, I don't think people think that. Indiana versus Illinois, well, that's a little different picture. But, you know, you don't really find strong relationships of these incentive differentials across states either with the past economic history of the state or the future economic development of the state. It doesn't mean incentives have zero effect, but what the fact that you have these huge differentials across state nearby states suggests these incentives cannot have large effects, or because if they did have large effects, you would see it. You would see South Carolina just booming ahead, North Carolina struggling, and you just don't see that.
Does that then make the argument that these tax incentives may not be worth the cost? Because there's a cost to doing them if you're going to offer
right.
them.
Right. What you need to, recognize, is there are also very large economic and social benefits, though, of higher job growth. In other words, creating more jobs in the local economy, if you can actually do it in a reasonably cost-effective manner, is worth quite a bit. It not only increases employment to population ratios, which makes it easier for local residents to find jobs, it also puts upward pressure on wage rates so that tends to increase the overall wage standard in the local economy. And of course, if there are high wage jobs, there are some spillover effects of that. So what it does indicate is that since incentives only have modest effects, I mean, this particular database suggests that the average incentive probably tips fewer than 10% of the location decisions it incents. So what that is saying is out of every 100 firms you offer an incentive, in 10 of those cases, you would not have had that kind of economic activity without the incentive. In the other 90 cases, either that firm or some similar firm would have been located in the state anyway. So you definitely, there's a cost to these incentives. In 90 out of 100 cases, your devoting resources, and this economic and job growth would have occurred anyway. But perhaps in the 10 cases where you are inducing new job growth has such powerful benefits, maybe it's worth it. But in order for it to be worth it, you really have to make sure that the jobs you're targeting, the jobs you're creating have high benefits, you know, in the sense of high, you know, high benefits for local residents. So, for example, if they pay higher wage rates, there's a direct benefit for workers from that. In addition, higher wage rates will lead to higher multiplier effects. If the jobs we bring into the local community pay higher wage rates, those workers in turn will be able to afford to buy more at local restaurants, other local retailers. That's going to create more spillover jobs. Similarly, if we target high-tech industries, there's a lot of evidence that high-tech industries tend to cluster together. There's some research that suggests that for every one job you create in a high-tech industry, there are going to be five spillover jobs creating the local economy because of this clustering effect of high tech. So if you target high wage and high tech industries, it may be that even though your batting average for getting firms through incentives is low, you know, it's like you're hitting a home run. It kind of depends on whether you're hitting a home run or a single, and or a grand slam versus a single with no one on base and two outs. If you're hitting a home run, if it's a high wage, high tech industry, maybe it's worth it. The other thing is, if you can design the incentives so they're a little bit more effective than the average incentive, that also makes a major difference. Research suggests, for example, that customized job training, under which community colleges will provide a newer expanding business with trained workers, is actually perhaps 10 times as effective as the average tax incentive. And yet states don't devote a lot of resources to customized job training. They devote some. But even states that tend to do a fair amount in customized job training, like Michigan, only one out of every nine incentive dollars in the state go to customized job training. The other eight go to tax incentives. And yet customized job training is one of the most effective incentives in tipping location and expanse decisions. Why? Because you're providing a valuable service to small and medium-sized businesses that particularly value things like customized job training. That small and medium-sized businesses that have more trouble affording training on their own or having dedicated training resources on their own. So we, in general, what this database suggests is that if we're going to make incentives work for state residents, we need to design them better than we currently do, and we need to target them more on firms that provide higher benefits and design them so that they're more effective than the average incentive is today.
I want to go back to what you said about the possibility of trying to target these in such a way that you could bring in high-tech firms because there are some very good multipliers with that. And as you said, you don't necessarily need to have a really good batting average on those to have some effect. But is it still a gamble? I mean, if your batting average is zero and all the high-tech firms go elsewhere, are you then in a situation where you've put your eggs in this one basket where you really have not generated any economic development?
Oh, sure. And you need to recognize there's always an opportunity cost to the funds that you're devoting to this. So obviously, if your batting average is zero, none of these programs make sense. It doesn't make a difference what you're targeting. If you're batting zero...
But are you more likely to bat zero if you say we want these particular types of firms as opposed to saying, well, we could bring in, you know, this type and this type and this type?
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's really any evidence whether there's a different batting average in those cases. You know, that you're competing with other states for all these firms anyway, so I don't think there's any difference. But you're right. You want to consider whether or not you can tip a given firm's decision. That's an important thing. I just don't know whether state officials really know when they can tip a decision or not. I mean, a lot of times, for example, you'll find in state laws that there's a requirement that incentives can only be given when the incentive, when the company would not have located but for the incentive in the state.
And how so do you know that?
Well, you know, that's actually written into Michigan state law for some of our incentives and has been for some years. And I was actually testifying for the state legislative committee the other day, and I said, well, look, unless you know of telepaths that the State Economic Development Department can employ, this state law is unenforceable. You can legislate all you want. You can say all you want that we're not going to give incentives unless the company would not have located but for the incentive. But how on earth is it possible for even the most exemplary economic development agency official to do that unless they can read the minds of the location decision maker. And they can't read their minds. They just don't know. The firm has all the information on what its options are. The state is at a disadvantage, does not have this information. It's not really possible with to get that information. So you can
take somebody's word for it, I guess.
Well, yeah, but what are they going to say? If they want the incentive, right. The company obviously is going to say, well, you know, we of course, we had these sites in Indiana and Ohio and Illinois, and we've done this detailed analysis. Here's the spreadsheet that we definitely, they would have been better locations, and the incentive you offered was needed to make Michigan the most profitable location. Well, okay, so you present these spreadsheets. Where do the numbers come from? There are lots of employees of a large corporation. Someone can come up with those numbers and make certain assumptions. I'm an economist. I know how you could, if you wanted to rig those comparisons, it wouldn't be that hard to do. It'd be pretty easy.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. My guest is Upjohn Institute for Employment Research economist Tim Bardick. We're discussing his research on the incentives that states use to bring in new businesses. A version of this interview originally aired in March. So we've mentioned Michigan a couple times, and Michigan was a state which offered a lot of incentives back in the 90s when Governor Snyder was elected. He said that he wanted to move to a system where there would be a business-friendly climate, but not as many individual incentives for companies. And based on what you said there about a lot of times it's tough for a state to know how you tip these things, is there an argument for that? And you know, you hear the conservative refrain on this is the government shouldn't be picking winners and losers. You should just try to make your state business friendly, and if the businesses that want to come there will come. Now Michigan's reconsidering that, but is there an argument to be made for what has happened under Governor Snyder to date?
Well, you've cut back on state taxes. I mean, the argument against it is that if you cut business taxes across the board, that's relatively inefficient from an economic development perspective. So when you cut business taxes across the board, you're cutting business taxes for a manufacturing company that is paying high wages and bringing dollars into the state and has high multiplier effects. So that's good, cutting business taxes on that company, other things equal. You're also cutting business taxes on McDonald's. And you know, I have nothing against McDonald's or Burger King or Wendy's or whatever. But the reality is that in terms of driving economic development, if you cut business taxes on a McDonald's, it's not going to lead to some dramatic expansion of fast food restaurant jobs. Because how many fast food restaurant jobs you have in an area, it largely depends on the number of people in the area, their incomes, and whether or not they want fast food versus some other kind of food. So it's kind of a combination of population, income, and taste. And the taxes, the business taxes on those fast food restaurants is not going to result in some major differential in the number of fast food restaurant jobs.
Which is why they're everywhere in all 50 states.
So there's some good reason that you might want to target some of your tax breaks on these industries that bring new dollars into the state, the base industries, the so-called export-based industries of the state. You might also want to target higher wage industries because they have higher multiplier or high tech, as I'm saying. So the argument is you want to target, but the question is how you target. So for example, there's really a tendency for states to want to target only large businesses. So you'll frequently find in state bills that are proposed or in legislation that's actually enacted that in order to get an incentive, your company needs to create at least 250 jobs or 500 jobs. That sounds good, but then you have to ask the question, does it make any difference to state workers or state residents if you have one company create 500 jobs? Or 50 companies create 10 jobs, or for that matter, 500 companies create one job each? And the answer is really, it's hard to see why, from an economic point of view, that would make any difference. Do you really want to favor simply the companies that are big enough to trigger these laws so that they're adding 500 jobs at one time? Now, why is this done? Well, one, it holds down the cost of the incentive program if you just target these really big decisions. Second reason it's done is, frankly, from a political standpoint, you're going to have a lot more positive news coverage and political coverage if you do a ribbon cutting when a new company creating 500 jobs locates in Michigan than if 50 companies creating 10 jobs are locating or expanding in Michigan. It's a different political dynamic. But from an economic point of view, it really doesn't make any sense. Why are we favoring big business over small business? Or small business over big business, for that matter. I mean, if we're going to favor one, we might want to favor small business for a variety of reasons. But, you know, let's say you just want to be neutral. Why would you want to do this? And yet, frequently you find incentives written in this way. And it's, even when they're not written in this way, one of the issues with incentives, particularly if you make it so that companies have to apply for them, is that the large business has the personnel to deal with the application requirements. The small business, they got so many things going on, they don't have time to figure out the rules of these different incentive programs and apply for them.
I want to read here from what you write at the very beginning of your overview. With slower or no growth in the last 30 years in many Americans' living standards, political pressure has increased for state and local policymakers to do something to improve job opportunities. And the words "do something" are actually in quotation marks. Now, you're an economist, and this is a report on economics, but you have a little experience and a little knowledge of how politics works. Is the reality that when people who make policy, be they politicians or, the people in an administration, are trying to figure out how to do this, that politics is going to come into play here? Because you look around and say, well, Indiana did this. We've got to make it look like we're doing something. Even if even with the best intentions, you are being in a reactive state and trying to show people that, yes, we are doing something to try and bring in jobs and make sure they pay well.
Right. And I think states can do something. I think states should take some responsibility for trying to improve their economy to create more jobs for state residents. They shouldn't just wave their hands and say nothing can be done. But they need to target things that have high ratios of benefits to cost and really deliver for people. And they need to evaluate their programs to make sure they're doing that. So in my view, states should be focusing in on, are we providing some very targeted investment incentives or job creation incentives on high wage and high tech industries? Are we doing the kind of incentives that seem to be more effective, like some of these customized services, such as customized job training, which seems much more effective, particularly for small and medium-sized businesses? Are we targeting that kind of activity? And if we're doing that, then we are, in fact, hopefully getting a higher benefit-cost ratio for state residents in terms of creating jobs. We are doing something. And then we need to evaluate these programs, too. We need to, for customized job training, I'm not saying that anytime any state sets up a program they call a customized training program, that necessarily it's a good program. It could be that the training provided is low quality or that it's not delivered in an effective way or that there's political favoritism in terms of who gets the training or whatever. So we need evaluations, and we need to ask, what was the performance of the assisted firms versus similar firms that were not assisted? So if we were allocating the assistance, if we had some point scoring system where, firms that were creating higher wage jobs, we could have a point scoring system where we could see who was performing. Firms that were assisted versus similar firms who were unassisted, how did they perform? In other words, we need some rigorous evaluation. I mean, one of the things that is going on nationally around the country is that there is a movement towards an increased push for transparency, evaluation, and accountability for these incentive programs. I mean, I mentioned that the increase in incentives was most rapid in the 1990s, and since around 2001 and 2002, some states have gone up, some states have gone down. And as part of that, you see a real push for accountability. There are, I think, over 20 states that in the last 5 years or so have enacted requirements that tax incentives for business be regularly evaluated, not necessarily every year, but every 3 years, every 5 years, that some state agency be authorized to look at them as rigorously as possible. An outside agency, not necessarily the Economic Development Agency, someone outside the Economic Development Agency, some independent group, legislative audit type group, look at the incentive and see if it's actually working. And I think that accountability movement is a very good thing. There also is a transparency movement. The Government Accounting Standard Board, about a year and a half ago, enacted a standard that pretty soon we're going to be getting lots of data on how much revenue state and local governments are foregoing through incentives. There's a disclosure requirement that if the governmental body wants to meet generally accepted accounting principles, it will now need to annually declare how much in revenue it's foregoing due to different tax incentives. And that will be disclosure, and journalists like you will be able to get this data and look at it and talk about what is the city of Kalamazoo or Kalamazoo County or different Detroit or the state as a whole, how much is being given away on these different deals.
Are there still things that we need to know out there? I guess I'm wondering, you know, how complete you think you've got this, or are there some things that if you could add another metric or two might tell us just a little bit more, and maybe things that just aren't readily available right now?
Oh, yeah. There's a number of things I'd like to improve this database in. So what this database tries to report in terms of incentives is what I would call the usual deal a state offers a typical firm it's trying to attract. Now, what I can't really assess in this, so I tried to not look at incentives that only go to, say, one company one time. But I can't really assess what percentage of companies that might qualify for the usual deal actually get it. And one thing I would like to do down the road is try to attach a probability to that. There are also incentives I couldn't include because there's just no data. For example, there is a type of incentive that is very commonly used around the country, including Michigan, for economic development purposes and also other purposes, called tax increment financing.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we use this in Kalamazoo, downtown Kalamazoo. It depends what we call economic development, but it's used to help redevelop the downtown area. Tax increment financing, a lot of money goes into these things. Under this thing, you declare some geographic area, a TIF district, a tax increment financing district, and increases in some tax from some base period, rather than going to the governmental units you usually would go to, go into a special fund that typically can be used for various purposes in the TIF district. A lot of tax increment financing is used for economic development purposes. In other words, this revenue goes in, and then various incentives are handed out within the TIF districts to entice firms to locate in those districts. It also goes for infrastructure purposes. I would love to get comprehensive data on TIFs nationally, and I initially hoped to do this with this database. At some point, I said, okay, you can only do what you can do. A lot of states, the reporting on TIFs is so poor, there's no way to create a database that would be comparable across different states. So I'm hoping down the road that we can do that. And of course, I would also hope to regularly update this database. In other words, I'd hope down the road to, I'd like to go from 33 states to 50 states. That would be nice.
I'd also update the numbers and make them current.
I would update the numbers. The numbers go through 2015. I mean, obviously, it's 2017 now. Hopefully every 3 years or so, we can maybe add in another 3 years of data. And, and I'm sure that the database I tried to make it as accurate as possible. I looked at the incentive rules and tax rules in each state. I am sure that at some point there was some misinterpretation of some incentive rules. We try to be very careful with this, but, to err is human, as they say. So, yeah, down the road, we would hope to make this database more comprehensive in terms of states, more complete in terms of covering all incentives, not just the five. I think we include the main incentives that are provided, property tax abatements, job creation tax credits, investment tax credits, R&D tax credits, and customized job training. But there are others, such as tax increment financing districts, that were not included. I'd like to be able to find out a little bit more about what percentage of companies eligible for the usual deal actually get it, which does vary some from state to state.
Tim Bartik, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Tim Bartik is senior economist with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. Links to the database and the report on state and local government tax credits can be found at WMUK.org. A version of the interview with Tim Bartik originally aired in March. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.